Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 46, Text 41. Yata Brahma Rika Drishtya Brahmyati Vamahiyate Chite Katari Tatratma Karte Vaham Diyashmita Yata Brahma Rika Drishtya Brahmyati Vamahiyate Chite Kartari Tatratma Karte Vaham Diyashmita Yata Brahma Rika Drishtya Brahmyati Vamahiyate Chite Katari Tatratma Karte Vaham Diyashmrita Yata, as Brahmarika, because of whirling around, Drishtya, in one's vision, Brahmyati, whirling, Iva, as if, Mahi, the ground, Iyate, appears, Chite, the mind, Kartari, being the doer, Tatra, there, Atma, the self, Karta, the doer, Iva, as if, Ahamdiya, because of false ego, Smrita, is thought. Translation and purport by the disciples of Srila Prabhupada. Just as a person who is whirling around perceives the ground to be turning, one who is affected by false ego thinks himself the doer when actually only his mind is acting. Purport. Srila Vishvanatha Chakravarti gives a parallel idea. Although our happiness and distress are caused by our own interaction with the material qualities, we perceive the Lord to be their cause. Om Gyanatibrandasha Gananjana Sadakaya Chakshur Nitam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. Panchakopa Dubishchara Pudasana Devachara Patitano Pavanebi Vaishabhaya Mona. So we're in a section of the chapter 46 of Uddhava's visiting Vrindavan, where Uddhava is explaining the position of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, explaining the position of Krishna. Get this up there. So, departing a little bit from just the pastimes we have, which is often done in Srimad Bhagavatam, we have these philosophical verses interspersed with the Leela. So it's very nice like this. And in this verse is a little bit, I don't know if it's difficult to understand, but it takes a little bit of thinking about and careful reading. In the previous verse yesterday, Uddhava discussed how Krishna is beyond the modes of nature, yet controls them. So this verse you could sort of see as a bridging link, which partially explains that verse further and then kind of links to the next verse. In this particular verse, there's an analogy presented that helps us to explain Krishna's position, and that is the analogy of the person whirling around and perceiving that is the earth that is turning. Of course, we all know that as human beings in this material world, we're all afflicted with the four defects of cheating, propensity to make mistakes, we have imperfect senses, and we're always illusioned. So we can see this example is certainly an example of imperfect senses and perhaps illusion. In other words, the person who is himself spinning around, when you stop, you'll see everything spinning around you, so it looks as though the earth is spinning. So you can see it's a question of perspective, that one has a mistaken perspective. I was thinking about this. I don't know if this ever happens to you. You ever driven through those car washes? You know, and as soon as they start, you feel like your car is moving forward. You have that experience? You know, and I actually feel a little dizzy. And so I have to kind of look at the wall to get the proper bearing, right? Then you can see that it's really just, you know, these sprayers are moving past you and not the car, and not that your car is moving forward. So this is a similar kind of thing where if we don't have the right perception, if we don't have the right grounding, then we can easily mistake what is actually going on. So the analogy is given here that in false ego, we think, and by we means the soul, we think that we are the doer and is actually the mind. Why is it actually the mind? Because the mind is responsible for thinking, feeling, and willing. The mind is considered to be more or less the, not the repository, I don't know if that's the right word, but it's the focal point of the senses. The sensory information goes to the mind. The mind accepts and rejects, basically, Srila Prabhupada said. That's the business of the mind. Yeah, and all the sensory input it gets, it decides, yes, I want this, and no, I don't want this. This is favorable, this is not favorable. And therefore, this is actually what is, we could say, is the doer. And that's why it is said that the mind is actually the doer, because it is the mental process which is activating all of one's material activity within this material world. Of course, the intelligence then will help us to figure out how to get it. In other words, the misuse of intelligence is to think, all right, the mind wants this, how can I go about achieving that? Of course, the proper use of intelligence, Prabhupada describes, is discriminating between spirit and matter. That is what purified intelligence is meant for. But at any rate, we can see in this way that the mind actually perpetuates our activities in the material world, interacting with the material modes of nature. So now this becomes sort of a lead into the next verse. I don't want to go into it because that's another verse for another day, but it basically says the Supreme Lord is certainly not your son alone. Rather being the Lord, he's the son, soul, father, mother of everyone. So in a sense, it's kind of referring to perhaps an illusion that Nanda Maharaj, he's speaking with Nanda Maharaj and Yashoda at this point. In other words, they are also under somewhat of an illusion, thinking that this is just their son, when actually it's the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And then that that particular concept now becomes elaborated in the subsequent verses. So this is sort of an analogy verse that's a linkage between the former philosophical concepts that were being discussed about, you know, Krishna being in control of the material energy, and then kind of linking with the idea that it's under illusion that we think Krishna is our son, our friend, whatever, but actually he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Now, in this particular verse today, the analogy is continued a bit. In the purport, it says, Srila Vishnu Chakravarti gives a parallel idea Although our happiness and distress are caused by our own interaction with the material qualities, we perceive the Lord to be their cause. Now, I have to admit, when I first read this, I didn't find it completely clear, because we know that Krishna is Sarvakaranakaranam. He's the cause of all causes. So in some sense, you could say Krishna probably is, it could be seen as the cause. And here it's saying it's illusion to think that Krishna is a cause, which is more or less saying it's your own interaction with material nature, which is the cause of your, which is your cause of your happiness and distress. In other words, don't blame Krishna, is kind of what's being said here. But I found, since this was quoted from Vishnu Chagavai Thakur, his purport on this verse actually explains a little further. So I thought I would read it since it was referenced here, because I think it clarifies, you know, that there's some conflicting concepts here, but we need to have a full vision of the spiritual Siddhanta to understand how Krishna is the cause and is not the cause. So Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says, Uddhava said, actually Krishna is not the creator of the universe either, since even that is executed by the modes of nature. Due to a defect in the bodily functions, a person may perceive that the earth is turning around like a potter's wheel. Similarly, though the mind is the doer, the living entity perceives the soul as the doer due to identification with the mind. In the same way, the living entity perceives the universe as the creation of the Lord, though it is actually the creation of the modes of nature, gunas. It should be understood, however, that though the material universe is not a direct creation of Krishna, it is a creation of Krishna's Maya Shakti, coming from the Lord. As Krishna and his energy are non-different, one can say the Lord, in the form of his Maya Shakti, does create the world. So a little more explanation on that point. And I looked to see what Srila Prabhupada said in the Krishna book. He doesn't really, you know, there's not a lot of emphasis on this particular verse. He talks more about the concepts before and after. But in the Krishna book, Prabhupada says, but in fact, Krishna is the overseer of this material creation. And while remaining unaffected by the material modes of nature, he creates, maintains, and dissolves the whole cosmic manifestation. I think it was actually yesterday's verse, probably, that Prabhupada is referring to. Then he says, we wrongly look upon Krishna and Balaram as ordinary human beings, just as whirling men see the whole world whirling around them. So that's what Srila Prabhupada says about it. Another little bit different perspective. He's saying that just as we're in this illusion of thinking that things are turning when actually we are turning, we may also see Krishna and Balaram as ordinary human beings, not understanding their role as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So there's two or three different perspectives we can see that we could take this verse and the different commentators by our acharyas and by Srila Prabhupada. But I think the conclusion or what we could say is that our lack of perspective, our illusion, prevents us from seeing the spiritual reality. In other words, the example is given here that, you know, that we often are covered over, we are illusioned, our senses are imperfect, so we don't understand the spiritual reality of either ourselves and our own activities or of the role of Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, of how he is acting within this world. So that kind of brings us to the point then is, what is the spiritual reality? Is Krishna the creator? Is he not the creator? Is it all the material modes of nature? Is it all basically all happening because of our will of our mind? Or what? First of all, we can understand both things. Krishna is the creator and the control of the material energy, but yet he remains aloof from them. In the seventh chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, we hear, Bhumirapanilo vayu kamano buddhirevacha, ahankara matiya me bina prakriti ashtada. So bina means separated. So Krishna says that these eight energies, the material energies, they comprise my separated material energy. Now it's an interesting word, separated. So in other words, they are Krishna's energy, but they're somewhat separated from him. They're not his direct spiritual energy, in other words. Now this is explained a little further in the Bhagavad Gita, particularly in the ninth chapter, verses 4 and 5. Krishna says, by me, in my unmanifested form, this entire universe is pervaded. All beings are in me, but I am not in them. And yet everything that is created does not rest in me. Behold my mystic opulence. Although I am the maintainer of all living entities, and although I am everywhere, I am not part of this cosmic manifestation, for myself is the very source of creation. So even in the Bhagavad Gita, we have this Achintabheda concept, right? The Krishna is both part of the universe and aloof from the universe. He says that everything does not rest on him, but at the same time, he is the maintainer of all living entities, and he's everywhere. But yet, he still is aloof from the cosmic manifestation. The purport to 9.5, Srila Prabhupada says, nice explanation, there's actually the purports of 9.4 and 9.5 are very nice, where Srila Prabhupada really explains this concept very clearly and gives some nice analogies to help us to understand it. He says, the Lord says that everything is resting on him. This should not be misunderstood. The Lord is not directly concerned with the maintenance and sustenance of this material manifestation. Sometimes we see a picture of Atlas holding the globe on his shoulders. You've all seen that from the Greek mythology, right? Of Atlas, and he's got the whole world right up on his shoulders. So in other words, everything is resting on him. We might think of that, you know. So he seems to be very tired holding this great earthly planet. Such an image should not be entertained in connection with Krishna's upholding this created universe. He says that although everything is resting on him, he is aloof. Actually, Balaram holds it up, doesn't he? Not the station. The planetary systems are floating in space, and this space is the energy of the Supreme Lord, but he is different from space. He is differently situated. So in other words, it is through his energies that Krishna upholds and maintains and supports this universe. Now, going back to the previous purport, 9.4, probably gives a nice example of the king. How, because of his energy, or by his energy, the king is present in all the different departments, you know, of his kingdom, of his administration, but yet he remains a separate person. So Prabhupada says, just as the sunshine is spread all over the universe, the energy of the Lord is spread all over the creation. And everything is resting in that energy. Yet one should not conclude that because he is spread all over, he has lost his personal existence. To refute such an argument, the Lord says, I am everywhere and everything is in me, but still I am aloof. For example, a king heads a government, which is but the manifestation of the king's energy. The different governmental departments are nothing but the energies of the king. In other words, his order, his instruction is making everything happen. And each department is resting on the king's power. But still, one cannot expect the king to be present in every department personally. So in other words, you know, and Prabhupada sometimes give an example, is the head of the state, is whether it's a king or a president, he's in charge of all the different departments, he's in charge of the prison department, but you're not going to go to the prison and see the president or the king, you know, managing, being the warden of the prison. No. In other words, that is a deputed agent of the king or the president or whoever the head of the government is. In the same way, Krishna has his deputed agents. He has the material energy. He has the modes of nature. He has the demigods. The demigods are in charge of different departments. So we have a demigod in charge of air, in charge of water, in charge of rain, in charge of the earth, etc. So these are all separate personalities who are all working under Krishna's direction, but yet we cannot say this is Krishna personally. Because what is Krishna personally doing? He's doing what we've been reading for the last few months. He's playing with his devotees in Vrindavan. That's his business. But at any rate, we can understand that even though that these are separated energies, we should never think that Krishna is not in charge. Because it's described in the kind of the culmination of those verses in the 9th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, 9.10, Maya Dakshina Prakriti Suyate Sacharacharam. Says this material nature, Krishna's energy, is working under his direction. It says very clearly, everything is working under his direction. So, yes, we can understand that Krishna is in charge of everything. It says not a blade of grass moves without the will of the Lord. This is absolutely true, but it's not all done by him personally, but it may be done through his energies. So this is a... we take this more or less for granted. This is fairly basic Krishna conscious philosophy. But yet it's actually a very, you could say, amongst world religions and philosophies, it's fairly esoteric. It's not that commonly understood. Because we're really talking about Lord Chaitanya's presentation of Achintabheda Tattva. This is the highest philosophy that's present. It's an interesting question. Is it eternally the highest philosophy that could ever be presented? We certainly know it is on the earth. It's the culmination of all of the Vedas. Lord Chaitanya took the essence of all of the Vaishnava, the different Vaishnava sampradayas. He took, you know, what was best from each one of those groups and synthesized it into the highest philosophy. So at least we don't know of anything higher than Achinta Veda Veda Tattva philosophy of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And just to summarize, we can say that we know that Krishna and the living entity are qualitatively one, but quantitatively different. So one and different. You know, we are the same nature, Satchitananda, Vigraha, but Krishna is very large, we are very small. And Krishna has both impersonal and personal features. It's one and different. Is he personal? Is he impersonal? He's both. It's very easily understood from reading the pages of the Srimad Bhagavatam and the Bhagavad Gita. Yes, he has his impersonal feature. He has his Brahman feature, his Paramatma feature, and his Bhagavan feature. They are all there. But yet, he keeps his own identity. It's not that he becomes Brahman and, you know, he's completely sort of differentiated, dissolved into the Brahman. No, this is one energy emanating from the body of Krishna, but Krishna's body remains intact. He still remains Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and his effulgence is this Brahman energy. We also know that nothing is different from Krishna, nothing is different from the Absolute, but yet Krishna remains aloof, as we've been talking about today, and works through his varied energies. And we can understand that Krishna and his creation are understood through understanding his energies. So there's many, many places throughout our scriptures, especially in Prabhupada, writes extensive purports where he talks about the different energies of Krishna. So we hear this in many, many places about Krishna's differentiated energies. We hear about, you know, in fact, in the introduction to the Bhagavad Gita, which is, of course, a very, very wonderful explanation of our entire philosophy, is in there, that intro to Bhagavad Gita. It's really worth reading, you know, regularly, like every year or so, to go back and read that, because everything is there. And there, Prabhupada very clearly talks about, you know, the five principles the Bhagavad Gita covers. First of all, Purusha, the Supreme Personality of Godhead; Prakriti, the material energy; Jiva, the spirit soul. So these are, of course, three principal energies, which are also mentioned in the seventh chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. And then time, kala, and karma, right? Those are the five principal topics of Bhagavad Gita that are mentioned in the introduction. So it's throughout, Prabhupada emphasizes, if we understand how Krishna is working through his energies, we can get it. We can understand the Supreme Absolute Truth. Because you don't understand Krishna just by understanding, you know, only just, you know, Krishna in his pastimes, and you don't really quite understand it just by some dry theoretical philosophy of Krishna, the creator and the maintainer. You have to understand both. Krishna as that person, that personality that we have a direct, personal, loving relationship with, and Krishna also, who is creating, maintaining, and eventually annihilating this entire material universe. So his connection with this material creation is through his energies. So once we understand that, or we try to understand that the best we can, we hear this philosophy, what's the conclusion? The conclusion in the seventh chapter, after you understand all this, is Bahunam Jamanamante Gyanavamam Prabhajante Vasudevam Sarvamiti Samahatma Sadurlava. After many births and deaths, one who is actually acknowledged surrenders unto me, knowing me to be the cause of all causes and all that is. Such a great soul is very rare. So, again, you know, sometimes we think the conclusion is Sarvadharma Pratyaja in the 18th chapter, but yet all throughout the Bhagavad Gita, we're getting the same message consistently from Krishna. Because the one who, if you actually understand this, you understand how I am working, you understand my energies, what is the conclusion? By one who is very, who's intelligent, who's a great soul, and one surrenders unto me, Prabhajante. You know, what other conclusion could one come to? If one understands the greatness of Krishna, the glories of Krishna, understands his position as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, you'd be rather foolish to come to any other conclusion except that I must surrender to Krishna and realize my relationship, you know, as Krishna's servant, as Krishna's eternal servant. So, when one understands that, one becomes what we call a devotee of Krishna, a bhakta. Now, there may be bhaktas and all kinds of bhaktas of different degrees and different realizations. We're not saying that we are the only bhaktas in the world, but it's a very good place to perform bhakti yoga under the guidance of Srila Prabhupada and the acharyas in this Brahma Gaudiya Vaishnava Sampradaya. Because one can get this full understanding of Krishna as the Absolute Supreme Personality of Godhead and understand and learn about our relationship with Him and how to go about serving. Other religions sometimes, you know, or often, I would say, even come to the conclusion that God is great and that we should be servants of, or we should be servants of God or subservient to God, but sometimes the actual execution of that service is a little bit vague. Like maybe you think, well, there's some commandments or act good or be good to other people. But most of that is centered around our relationships within the material world relating with, you know, with Prakriti and with Jiva. You know, not so much how we actually relate to God. You know, what is our actual relationship and what do we understand about God? That's given to us in Bhakti Yoga. Bhakti Yoga is this complete science of how we serve God in love and devotion. So, what are the devotees doing? Well, we're reading about what the devotees are doing in the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. That's one of the reasons why Bhagavatam is there, and the 10th canto is the culmination. And why Srila Prabhupada gave us Krishna book back in 1970, I believe it was published. Very, very early on, when we could barely understand. I wasn't even there. I wasn't even a devotee at that time, but a couple years later. But very, very early on, even with our limited realization, Prabhupada gave us the Krishna book because he knew the importance of the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, obviously having that sort of spiritual foresight that he may not be able to complete the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. And of course he didn't. He only was able to go through complete chapter 13 of the Srimad Bhagavatam 10th canto and not the rest of the Bhagavatam. So he wanted to make sure that we had those pastimes of Krishna, because that is our example. You know, we think, well, what is a devotee? Those are our prototypes. Those are our exemplars of devotional service. Nanda Maharaj and Yashoda, the gopis, the cowherd boys, all the residents of Vrindavan, you know, even the trees and the grass and the cows. You know, these are all our exemplars of pure devotional service. So what does Krishna do? He acts primarily through his spiritual energy with his devotees. In C.C. Adi Lila 460, Prabhupada is talking about how Krishna acts for his own pleasure through his pleasure potency. He says, the Hladini is the personal manifestation of the blissfulness of the Supreme Personality of Godhead by which he enjoys pleasure. When the pleasure potency of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is exhibited by his grace in the person of a devotee, that manifestation is called love of God. Therefore, devotional service reciprocated between the Lord and his devotee is an exhibition of the transcendental pleasure potency of the Lord. Now that's interesting, isn't it? It's not just about our relationship, but, you know, this is sort of looking at it from Krishna's side, from Krishna's perspective. He's exhibiting his Ladini potency. This is his pleasure potency, and he actually experiences pleasure through his relationships with his devotees. So that is his desire. Explained a little bit more in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Prabhupada explains that his purport, 9465, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is self-sufficient, but to enjoy his transcendental bliss, he requires the cooperation of his devotees. In Vrindavan, for example, although Lord Krishna is full in himself, he wants the cooperation of his devotees, like the cowherd boys and the gopis, to increase his transcendental bliss. Not only does the Supreme Personality of Godhead enjoy the company of his devotees, but because he is unlimited, he wants to increase his devotees unlimitedly. And I think this is an interesting point that I noted. You know, so in other words, you know, why are we worried about all these conditioned souls? Well, not just to save them, but Krishna wants to enjoy unlimitedly. Thus, he descends to the material world to induce the non-devotees and rebellious living entities to return home back to Godhead. He requests them to surrender unto him because, unlimited as he is, he wants to increase devotees unlimitedly. So that's a kind of an interesting way of looking at it, isn't it? In other words, devotees coming back to Krishna consciousness is increasing the pleasure of the Lord. And that's what devotees want to do. We want to give Krishna pleasure. That is our job as Krishna's surrendered devotees. You know, in other words, why do we offer wonderful flowers and decorations and artik and sing and chant and in front of Krishna to give him pleasure? It's not really for us. I mean, we get pleasure out of it because it's a reciprocal loving relationship. Automatically, when Krishna's pleased, we become pleased when we're, so that's there. But ultimately, it's to give Krishna pleasure, you know. So, bringing those conditioned souls to the lotus feet of Krishna gives Krishna immense pleasure because he is so unlimited, he wants to unlimitedly relate to unlimited numbers of jiva and have loving relationships with all of them. So sometimes in our preaching work, we think that this is all for the benefit of the falling living entities, but we can also understand, of course it is, and that mood of compassion is prominent in the hearts of the great devotees. That compassion for the suffering of the living entities, to want to bring them back to their original position of enjoyment and relationship with Krishna and experiencing that bliss, but it's also to increase the pleasure of the Lord, as we're seeing here. So the devotee ultimately wants to do that which gives pleasure to the Lord, and by pleasing Krishna, it's described here that the devotee partakes in that Vaidini potency, that pleasure potency of Krishna. And devotees who engage in this preaching work on behalf of Krishna to help bring his devotees back to him to increase his pleasure certainly do partake in that Vaidini potency, in that pleasure. And this is something that, you know, we all experience when we are involved in the Sankirtan movement, when we're involved, whether it be Harinam or whether it be giving out books or preaching or just talking to somebody or just telling somebody about Krishna or even inspiring the devotees about Krishna. We feel a little bit of that pleasure potency. It's there. And that keeps devotees very, very motivated. Sometimes we wonder how, devotees can, we see some of our very stalwart preachers, how they can go out and do this day after day, year after year, like that. Well, they may have, sometimes you might think materially, well, they have some propensity for it or whatever, or this people's nature. Of course, that may be there. But at the same time, there is that real pleasure and that enjoyment that one receives by being part of Lord Chaitanya's mission. And therefore, and of course, Srila Prabhupada's mission. And when we please the Guru, and we please Lord Chaitanya, and we ultimately are pleasing Krishna by helping to bring the conditioned souls back to him, then we all partake of that pleasure potency. And it's a very, very wonderful experience. So, and in fact, that experience that we have of giving Krishna consciousness to others, we don't really give Krishna consciousness to others, we make Krishna consciousness available to others, and they may take it or not take it. So we assist our guru in making Krishna consciousness available. And when we do that, there's very, very great pleasure in that. And that tends to transcend everything else. It tends to transcend the difficulties, the problems, interpersonal issues or difficulties that we might have when we're working together in that way. So we often experience that when we're all chanting Hare Krishna together, when we're experiencing some festival or some, Rath Yatra or whatever it may be, all the devotees are blissful. And for a moment, just for a moment, some of us are able to forget, my promise with this devotee and that devotee, and we just become, part of that Vaidini Shakti, that pleasure potency of the Lord, and involved in this very, very wonderful pastime. Of course, we have all these wonderful pastimes of Vrindavan, and we're relishing these as we're reading these. But we're also simultaneously involved in Lord Chaitanya's pastimes, in the Navadvip Mayapur pastimes as well. Pastimes in Vrindavan are the Madhurya pastimes, very, very sweet pastimes. But the pastimes of Lord Chaitanya are called Adurya, right? Adurya pastimes, which means those that are very merciful, the magnanimous nature of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So those are also very, very wonderful pastimes. And we've been very, very fortunate, when you think about it, from the historical perspective and, you know, the millions of years we've been around in this material world. So in other words, we can't just think of, you know, this particular lifetime, but of all the lifetimes we've been in, and all the living entities, and all the universes, and all the planets, here we are in a situation where we're able to engage in Krishna's Vrindavan Leela and Lord Chaitanya's Leela as well, simultaneously. I don't know how it all works, but it's pretty wonderful. It's pretty amazing, you know. And again, this was all, you know, this was explained to us, was brought to us by Srila Prabhupada. And as we read his books and his teachings and his purports and we hear him, you know, it's just continually amazing that this incredibly complex philosophy, you know, somehow or another, was presented to us in a simple fashion, you know, so that we could understand Krishna consciousness and we could take to it. You know. So I think I'll stop at that point. Are there any questions first? Let's start with Namamrita.
Thank you. Nice class. I was just curious about the Achintabheda-Bheda-Tattva philosophy. It seems like it can be applied in, there's different examples of it. So yeah. It's not just one, for example, Krishna and Radharani, one and different.
Right.
There's different parts to it. I just kind of had that realization as you're describing it. Could you maybe, is it easy to enunciate all the different ones? Is it limited, or are there hundreds of different ways to apply Achintabheda-Bheda-Tattva?
Well, there's probably unlimited ways, and of course Achinta means inconceivable, so ultimately we can't understand all of the ways, because it is, in a way, I mean, even think of, you know, sometimes people even think about, well, what's infinity, you know, or, you know, can there be, you know, time, and can it start, can it not start, or where's the end of the universe, but how could it end? These are actually all Achintabheda-Bheda, you know, tattva type of conceptions, you know, and they're all answered by Krishna consciousness, how things can be, unlimited and yet limited. And in fact, besides the things I was talking about, how, you know, Krishna and the living entities are one and different, and how Krishna is both personal and impersonal, Krishna is both within the world, without the world, he remains one, even though his energies are spread. You know, these are the sort of the obvious manifestations of the Achintabheda-Bheda-Tattva. But Prabhupada also even gives an example of Krishna smaller than the smallest, but yet larger than the largest. You know, so there's many, many ways, I think, there's probably more people could think of how this manifests. And sometimes I don't have it right in mind, but I wrote it down other times and thought about it, that we see many, many examples, even in this material world, of things being simultaneously one and different. You know, in fact, I would say it's a very pervasive nature of reality, you know, because, of course, everything, even the material energy, is a reflection of the spiritual, and Prabhupada makes the point very clearly that, you know, everything material comes from spiritual energy. So, yeah, we see it operating in many, many different ways. Okay, go ahead, Hari. Brian? Yes, Hannah. Give it a try. No? It was on before. Go ahead. Through Keshava's determination, we will get the microphone working.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So maybe I should repeat. You mentioned that the fact that the material creation is Krishna's inferior energy, that's like a basic point for us, which is true. because we hear it so many times. But actually, that's the key departure between our philosophy and the Vaishnava philosophy in general and the Advaita vision, Advaita philosophy. So the Advaitavadis, what they do is, they give these analogies, the process of Anvaya and Vyatirek, connection and separation. So here's an example. There's a pot, you break the pot, the pot's made of clay, but once the pot's broken, there is no pot, but the clay remains. So that means the clay is real and the pot is false. The same thing they do with the beads on a string. The string, if it's not there, there is no necklace. So, but yet, the string is real. It's separate from the beads. So the idea is that this world is all false. Right. So they extend this to say, when you are actually awake, you're seeing this world, you're perceiving it. But when you're sleeping in deep sleep, you're not seeing this world, but you exist. So that means the world is false and you are real. So the conclusion is this whole material creation is actually an illusion. The deity is an illusion, material forms are illusion, everything is illusion. Actually, Brahman is the only reality. That's the conclusion they come up with. And so they become offenders to Krishna. So Jiva Goswami, in his Shat Sandarbha, he takes a lot of effort to hammer this idea down by again and again pointing out that the Shaktis of Krishna, material world is an inferior Shakti, because if the world is an illusion, nobody is controlling it. There is no supreme controller. We are the supreme. We just have forgotten it. So there is a supreme controller whose inferior energy this material world is. Jiva Goswami hammers that, and Prabhupada actually does that in every page of his purports. Actually, this is a very critical point that, you know, this is where the two philosophies diverge.
Yeah, and even, and as you said, even if we think it's fairly simple and basic, it is simple and basic for the Vaishnavas. But when you go out and you talk to others, you're going to get this opposite, you know, Mayavadi or impersonal view very, very often. You know, that's something that we do encounter. So we do have to understand these points very clearly. Yeah. Janmashtami.
Great class, Prabhu. From the purport of today's verse, although our happiness and distress are caused by our own interaction with the material qualities, we perceive the Lord to be their cause. Now, once one becomes a devotee, then karmani nirahati kintu cha bhakti bhajan, you know, is no longer under the laws of karma. And at that point, should a devotee see that it actually is Krishna doing these things?
Absolutely. The advanced devotee understands that any happiness or distress they're experiencing, you know, if they're actually a devotee under the internal potency, following the orders of the spiritual master, is somehow or another directly coming from Krishna or being handled by Krishna. Of course, there's the winding down of past karma, you know, the pulling the plug on the fan analogy, but even that is being directly handled by Krishna.
Right. One other quick question. It seems that part of the pacification that Uddhava is trying to achieve, or the method that he's using, is to dispel the yoga mayak.
A little bit, yeah.
Illusion.
Yeah.
Which is pretty interesting.
Yeah, because especially in the next few verses, Uddhava goes on further saying, you know, you're thinking Krishna is your son, but he's actually not. He's everyone's son, father, the supreme, and like that. So, yeah, he's in one sense, he's sort of giving them a reality check or perspective on who is Krishna, and to remember that. You know, of course, you know, they go in and out of, you know, yoga maya and this higher realization. And usually when they get too much involved in that higher realization of really understanding Krishna, it doesn't really cause happiness for them, because that disturbs their rasa, their relationship. So usually then, you know, they get covered a little bit by yoga maya. So they're going to say, yes, but that's all true. But Krishna's still just our son. Yeah, Tripa Krampu.
Hare Krishna. Very nice class. I like the example the Lord gave in the Uddhava Gita to Uddhava about how he controls this material world. And he says, just like the spider sends forth its web, and then it it winds it up back, like in the night it sends forth it, and then it winds it back in the day. So just like that, at the beginning of Brahma's day, everything is set forth, and then the night everything winds back.
Yeah.
Very nice example, like the spider, you know.
Yeah, I remember reading that. That's a good analogy. Any other last things?
Is that Adi
4.60? I think it was chapter 4, verse 60. 60, yeah. Okay, thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.